From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Rural hospitals across the country are struggling to keep their doors open. Voters in Modoc County in the remote northeastern corner of California will soon decide whether to tax themselves to save their local hospital. The county has gone broke trying to keep the hospital open, and that has led to a fractious debate in a proudly conservative frontier community. From member station KQED, Sarah Varney reports.
The hospital hallways here, like the nights, are quiet. It's been years since pregnant women could deliver their babies at Modoc Medical Center. A surgeon comes just twice a month to do simple procedures. Even the helicopter pad is sprouting weeds. But it's no exaggeration to say that the county hospital in Alturas, even with its limited services, is a lifeline to the people who live here. The closest full-service hospitals are hours away, and the nearby medical centers over the mountains are often unreachable during winter storms.
They gotta have something.
Vicki Smith moved here as a young girl. She's now 61 and owns the Main Street Family Diner.
There's a lot of retired people here, a lot of them. And if they don't have medical, they'll have to leave.
The talk of the diner and elsewhere in the remote Pitt River Valley is the fiscal calamity that could force the hospital to close and the county to go bankrupt. An outside audit found that county supervisors improperly used restricted funds to bail out the hospital, which was losing millions of dollars a year. Now, the county has to pay back some $12.5 million in federal and state grants, and the hospital is on its own to make ends meet.
It's almost living paycheck to paycheck, basically.
Monica Derner is the hospital's interim CEO, the seventh CEO in the last 4 years.
And some months are better than other months, and it's kind of just juggling the finances around to make it work right.
Somewhere along the way, a county supervisor uttered the unutterable, that the Modoc Medical Center just might have to close. The suggestion enraged residents here, especially those who came to Modoc with their Medicare cards to retire. A group formed to save the hospital. They held evening meetings and collected signatures. And now, at the end of this month, voters here will decide whether to increase their property taxes to fund their hospital.
Good afternoon. I'm Lou Miller with Save Our Hospital Committee. And we have some information.
Lou Miller is a retired security guard who has the unenviable job of selling a tax hike here. Modoc is California's most Republican county, where ads for the local Tea Party run prominently in the weekly newspaper.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't.
Still, Miller says the one thing voters here hate more than taxes is the thought of being stranded in Alturas or on a ranch with no ambulance service and no place to spend the night when felled by pneumonia or a hip fracture. The hospital in Alturas, though, is not just a lifeline. It's an economic engine, even if it is just sputtering along. Like many rural hospitals, Modoc Medical Center is the largest employer in town, and people here worry what will happen if it closes.
We'll be reduced probably to one grocery store. We'll probably lose a hardware store. We'll lose a lot of things. And a lot of people can stay here.
Judy Mason is secretary of the Save Our Hospital Committee.
Then you get a reduced value of properties. So now your tax base is smaller also. So the county becomes even more impoverished.
Still, there's strong opposition to the tax measure. Doug Knox retired with his wife to a small ranch outside of Alturas. His driveway is lined with American and Confederate flags, and he is single-handedly leading the opposition to the parcel tax with radio and television ads.
If it costs me $10,000, $15,000, I'm willing to do it. Because I do not believe that throwing money at a problem is the way to go it and put it on the backs of the taxpayers.
But even the staunchly conservative county supervisors, who've come under fire for creating the crisis, admit the parcel tax may be the only choice. Dan Maxey is president of the Modoc County Board of Supervisors.
We're in a battle right now. We don't want to go insolvent. That's not going to resolve anything. If the county goes down, the hospital goes down. The hospital goes down, the city goes down, and we don't want to see that happening.
The battle over the hospital and allegations of impropriety have engaged people here in county government in a way not seen in decades. Attendance at public meetings is at an all-time high, and in dozens of interviews, residents say they're beginning to challenge the closed-door way county officials have long conducted business. Even the county supervisors admit the uncomfortable scrutiny may in the end be a blessing. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We understand a little better now where all the oil went after the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Scientists have mapped out for the first time the path that some petrochemicals took. they traveled underwater. The so-called plume of oil compounds extends for at least 22 miles. And as NPR's Dan Charles reports, it's an important new piece of the puzzle.
For several months now, scientists have been reporting that some oil from BP's blown-out well was staying underwater. Christopher Reddy from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts told a news conference yesterday this was a big surprise.
If you asked me, and I've been studying oil spills for 15 years, whether or not you would see oil in a subsurface, I would say no, doesn't oil float?
That's fascinating, he says, but also troublesome, because if scientists don't know where the oil is, they don't know what harm it might be causing. In June, Reddy and his colleagues from Woods Hole took a research boat to the scene of the spill. They lowered a sensor deep into the water and towed it in a large circle around the blown-out well, looking for particular hydrocarbons that are easy to detect. The sensor picked up a signal southwest of the well in a layer of water 3,000 feet down. Richard Camilli, another researcher from Woods Hole, says they then sent down a new device, a small unmanned submarine with sensors on board called Sentry.
And we had Sentry fly at a constant depth in kind of a zigzag pattern, moving out from the well site, tracking the plume.
The hydrocarbons were highly diluted in the water. They were coming from the well, but they weren't spreading out in all directions. They followed an invisible underwater channel just over a mile wide and 650 feet deep. The researchers tracked that channel southwest for 22 miles until bad weather forced them to stop. They thought they might see microorganisms feasting on those hydrocarbons and breaking them down. Christopher Reddy says they didn't, and he doesn't know why.
Microbes are a lot like teenagers. They work on their own time, their own scale. They do what they want, when they want.
There are many other unknowns. Reddy and his colleagues don't yet know how much of the oil that gushed from the well is in this plume, although they hope to, months from now, when they've analyzed all their water samples. They also don't know how toxic it might be to wildlife. Still, this is the best documented case so far of oil flowing underwater. It was released yesterday by the journal Science.
This report is a big piece of the puzzle.
Stephen Murawski is trying to put the whole puzzle together and figure out where the oil went. He's the science advisor for fisheries for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Spread across the table in his office is a map of the Gulf of Mexico.
We've had up to 7 vessels at a time out here trying to map out the distribution of the underwater feature.
Murawski says more reports are coming about oil in the deep sea around the well. But he'd like to see more scientists working in other areas. On the continental shelf, for instance, the wide, shallow areas closer to shore.
This is the area where fisheries primarily occur. Now, we've got a very vigorous fisheries seafood safety monitoring program, but we need to do more water chemistry up there as well.
Murawski says he's drafting plans to expand such research, gradually painting a more complete picture of where the spilled oil went. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Our colleague Scott Simon remembers the moment that he and his wife decided to adopt. Scott and Caroline Simon traveled twice to China to bring back children. In his new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, the Saturday host of NPR's Weekend Edition says they decided to adopt after struggling to conceive.
We'd both been around the world. We'd both seen different places. We'd both been in places where there are a lot of children who'd been abandoned, and we just looked at each other and said, why are we doing this? There are children in the world now who need our love, and we sure need them.
This really is an emotional choice that you make. If you made a rational, if you had a rational thought process about it, if you tried to consider it as a business decision, you wouldn't really do it. It's something that you do because you want to do it.
It is an emotional choice, and for some people, adoption is just something that will that they think will never work with them, and so they decide not to do it. All of that being said, I would like to open that door for people. It is difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to adopt a child in this country. Whether you adopt internationally, as my wife and I did, whether you adopt domestically, may I say, as your family did, mm-hmm. as your parents did.
My parents did, yes.
And because of that, for a lot of people, the assisted fertility industry is just an obvious alternative to that. That being said, look, the instinct to adopt, to take children into our lives is, I think, practically as old as childbirth.
How much did you think about the fact in advance that the baby you were going to adopt from China was going to be a Chinese baby?
You know, we knew it, but I can't say we thought about it much. And we certainly didn't think about it much. We went to China to get both of our little girls. We want to travel back to China every few years so they can get a chance to see the country up close as they grow up. Mm-hmm. But all of that being said, it's a feature of their personality. It's, I think, not the defining trait of our relationship.
You write that somebody asked your wife, do you feel guilty for taking your daughters away from their native culture?
Yeah. A very learned woman who we like a lot, who's a friend of the family. And my wife just answered, no, not really. I think I would have had a tougher time holding my tongue. And that's because when we talk about ethnicity, we say Chinese. To someone who's Chinese, that's not necessarily their ethnicity. There are almost 100 ethnicities that are living in China. So in a sense, we don't really know their ethnicity. So we shouldn't get, I think, too preoccupied with it. One of my favorite vignettes that I have in the book is about Martin Simon, who was the son of the late Paul Simon, senator from Illinois, no mm-hmm. relation to me, alas, and Gene Simon, who grew up with, it appeared on his birth certificate that he was Native American. And he grew up, his father was an influential member of the Senate Subcommittee on Native American Affairs.
And
people, his high school friends would look at him and say, you know, Martin, he's part Cherokee. And people would say, yeah, you can tell when you look at him. And you might see where this story is going. Years later, he's 28 years old. He meets his birth mother, who's only 15 years older than him. They're talking and reaching out to each other and enjoying getting to know each other. But as he said to me, she looked just about as Native American as Diana, Princess of Wales. And he finally said to her, how are we Indian? And she said, Indian? He said, yes, in my birth certificate it says Native American. And she said, oh, they asked me what we were, and I said, we're all American. And as he said, you know, I spent all that time going to powwows. I mean, he felt Native American. He didn't feel Scandinavian, which turns out to be his ethnic heritage. But I think the point of that, firstly, is the power of suggestion. Mm-hmm. He said all of those years, nobody ever looked at him and said, come on, now, you're not American Indian. And I think it's also an instruction to us to not invest too much of our identity in ethnicity.
Your kids must be getting to that age, if they haven't practically always been in it, when they start asking you awkward questions about everything. What are some of the hardest questions you've heard from your kids?
The hardest question I've heard is from our 7-year-old daughter, Elise, who says, why did my mother give me up? And that's a rough one.
I'm sorry, you know, I get this way when I talk about my children.
It's okay. That's a rough one because she's old enough to understand that she was given up by a woman who, when we tell her your mother loved you and she wanted to take care of you for the rest of your life and she wanted to be a mother to you, but she just couldn't. Yet it's hard, I think, for a 7-year-old to understand. How do you explain China's one-child policy? How do you explain
the bias toward that one child being a boy rather
exactly.
than a girl?
Yeah. How do you really explain that? She also, you know, children tend not to be metaphorical the way we are. They're literal. So she asks because we've told her the story that we know that she was left in front of a light bulb factory, and she asks, was I cold?
Oh.
And. We say, no, you weren't. Your mother wrapped you up before she put you there on the sidewalk. Pretty confident that you'd be discovered by someone who would help you. So she wrapped you up. But, you know, I think to a degree I really respect in both of our youngsters, and it's audible now with Elise, they're comfortable with being adopted. There is no way that we're going to be able to spare them the sting and the hurt of feeling that at some point there was someone who gave them up. No matter how many times we explained your mother loved you, no matter how many times we explained that we're grateful for the courage your mother had to even bear you in China, I don't think we can spare her the hurt. But, you know, we learn from hurts in life, don't we? You know, we put something over them and we keep on going. And I think our two daughters are going to be are going to be very strong, in part because of that. I don't think they're going to be broken by that.
Scott Simon's latest book is called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
Photos of Scott's family are at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Tom Rockman is the author of The Imperfectionists. It's a book about the death of newspapers and has been described as a modern-day Dubliners. For our series, My Guilty Pleasure, where writers talk about a book they're embarrassed to love, Rockman recommends a very British collection of rogue remembrances.
Many things embarrass me, but reading isn't one of them. I'm not ashamed of my slightly weird collection of prison memoirs, nor the flaky meditation books. After all, I can pretend I never read those. My guilty pleasure is at the foot of the shelves, hidden in shadow. It's this, volume after volume of possibly ghoulish, probably macabre, thoroughly entertaining obituaries. The pleasure I get from reading obits is probably a little creepy. There must be something amiss, since I can't imagine doing it at a cafe, which is perhaps a good test of a guilty pleasure. My favorite is the Daily Telegraph Fourth Book of Obituaries. Its subject is rogues, and it combines an English affection for eccentrics and an English fascination with the slightly perverse and the very drunk. There's an obit about a brothel keeper from Marseille who ended her days, quote, toothless save for one rotting fang. An Australian politician who, quote, gained nationwide notoriety for his keenness to enter beer belly competitions, his habit of stirring his tea with his finger, and his regular nomination as one of Australia's worst-dressed men. Plus, a lowlife writer whose penchant for booze was so pronounced that, when commissioned to write an autobiography, quote, he had to place an advertisement asking if anyone could tell him what he had been doing between 1960 and 1974. A common defense among obituary fanciers such as myself is that the obit is not about death at all. It's about life. This is true, since an article about the condition of deadness would make for turgid reading at best. Yes, an obituary is a record of a human being condensed and terribly reduced. But it's also a tale from start to finish, a complete life, whole in a way that, ironically, its subject can never see. The obit is as close as news gets in structure to the short story. After all, how many other news articles have a conclusion? An obit also shares with literature a talent for the revealing detail, as in the Times of London obit of Cyril Connolly, which delightfully describes the intellectual's, quote, habit of marking his place in a book at the breakfast table with a strip of bacon. During my past career as a journalist, I relished writing obits and equally dreaded phoning relatives for the necessary facts. But to my surprise and great relief, they often wanted to talk. They wanted their recently deceased loved ones recorded in print. All those rogues in the Daily Telegraph Fourth Book of Obituaries had more to confess than I ever have. Still, when I close that book, a grin on my face, I'm the one who ends up looking guilty.
Tom Rockman is the author of The Imperfectionists. For more books, stories, reviews, and commentary, or to comment on this essay, you can go to npr.org. This is NPR.
Another day, another piece of disappointing economic data. This week, housing numbers, unemployment claims, and other economic indicators all came in worse than economists had predicted. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
It sure would be nice if economic recoveries moved in a straight line, up, up, up. But most of the time, that's not the way it works. Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board.
The warning here, in a sense, is what you see in August may not be much better come Christmas time.
Goldstein says there's just not a lot of momentum. The jobs picture is bleak. Consumer confidence is weak. Spending is flat.
There's a technical economic term. It's called death by a thousand cuts.
But William Rogers, an economist at Rutgers, says this type of lull has happened before, in 1991 and 2001. But he worries about what could happen if too much bad economic news rolls in.
I think you could start to see Wall Street and potentially Main Street could really start to psychologically begin to prepare that, oh, we are going to move to a double dip.
A double dip recession, that is. But Rogers and most economists still believe that doomsday scenario isn't likely. More likely, a long, slow slog to recovery. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Finding that missing oil may be easier than understanding how toxic it could be to marine life. That job is just getting underway, and its complexity is daunting. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some of the damage that scientists fear cannot be seen right away.
Out of sight is not out of mind for marine chemist Dana Wetzel, who works at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida.
You know, we want to say, yes, everything's all good. You know, the spill has been capped. But the fact is, we don't really know what it means in terms of long-term impacts to birds, marine mammals, fish, shrimp, oysters.
Today, Wetzel and two colleagues from the lab are motoring out into the pale blue waters of Sarasota Bay to test a device designed to find whatever oil is meandering through the Gulf. Wetzel calls it a virtual shellfish. It's a membrane, sort of like a strip of plastic inside a metal housing the size of a cell phone. Water flows across the membrane, which collects contaminants like oil.
So we can see what contaminants are in the sediments, what's right above the sediments in the water column, what the clams are accumulating, and then what the spotted eagle rays are accumulating from eating those clams.
Once the device tells scientists how much oil or dispersant is in the water or sediment, scientists can calculate how the contaminants work their way up the food chain as big animals like spotted eagle rays eat littler ones like clams. It's a joint project with Baltimore's National Aquarium and Johns Hopkins University. The plan is to offer the device to researchers in the rest of the Gulf. The team at Moat is doing the hands-on, or flippers-on, part of the research, diving into Sarasota Bay to plant and then retrieve these devices with their contamination fingerprints.
This is a much better approach in understanding the long-term impacts in an area versus simply collecting a water sample or a sediment sample.
That's because it's a big, big ocean. And a sample here and a sample there is hit or miss. These devices are 30-day records of all the contamination that passes through an area. The virtual shellfish is just a tiny part of what marine scientists say is an almost impossible job. Finding where the oil and dispersant have been and are going is hard enough. Then scientists have to figure out what the contaminants may have done or will do. For example,
if a whale dies or if a porpoise dies, you've got a dead body that you can see. But if larvae die, you have no idea what was there in the first place.
That's Richard Pierce, an oceanographer at Moat. When coral or giant tuna, for example, reproduce, they drop uncountable numbers of tiny larvae into the water. No one will know how many of them were or will be wiped out by the oil or dispersant. Some preliminary tests of the dispersant used to break up the oil show that it can kill coral larvae. And marine life that survives exposure could suffer long-term subtle effects that are very hard to measure.
Once it impacts an organism and affects their genes or affects their endocrine system, then the damage is done.
The endocrine system controls things like growth and reproduction by producing and regulating hormones. The damage may not be evident until the next generation of tuna and coral fails to show up in its usual numbers. Moat shark expert Robert Cuter says researchers are going to have to dig harder and spend more money to search for long-term damage.
We're going to have to look much deeper. We're going to be doing more looking inside the shark.
Even if biologists find something amiss, they'll then have to determine whether it was caused by the oil or the dispersant or something else. Kumar Mahadevan, the director at Moat, says it's not as if the Gulf was a terribly healthy place to start with.
This Gulf has been insulted with a whole bunch of environmental issues over the years, from stormwater runoff to sewage runoff to everything under the sun you can think. We've got everything, okay?
Mahadevan says there's still very little money available. Right now in Florida, over 200 scientific institutions are bidding for just $10 million that BP has offered the state. Moreover, he says with the Justice Department and BP preparing for litigation, scientists who take money from either side could be limited in what they can discuss or publish. And what scientists want to study, say the oil's effects on plankton, may not be what lawyers are looking for.
the legal system and the scientific system have different standards. And how this is all going to shake out is very interesting to watch.
And it could be a very long watch. Scientists say it will take years to assess the damage and years of lawsuits to determine who pays for it. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.